This Thursday on Here and Now with Dirk Richardson, the music of the ICP Orchestra. In addition to the usual mix of folk rock, psychedelia, and jazz, Dirk will sample the music of the ICP Orchestra, currently on its 40th anniversary tour. That's the Here and Now, Thursdays at 10 p.m. And you're listening to 94.1 KPFA in Berkeley, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, and 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. The time is 1 p.m. It's time now for Guns and Butter with Bonnie Faulkner.
This is Guns and Butter.
There's something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
The real role of the banking system and the Federal Reserve is to stave off, you know, this fire sale, bargain basement auction of greatly cheapened commodities that we call a depression. The last big one happening in 1929, and a more slow motion version of it happening since the late 60s, early 1970s. In other words, credit creation up to a point. When it's supplemented by all these free inputs, both from outside of the system and also in terms of grinding down living standards of working people inside the system, can put off for some time the day of reckoning. But as anyone can see reading the papers today, I think we're getting pretty close to that day of reckoning.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Lauren Goldner. Today's show, Fictitious Capital, Real Retrogression. Lauren Goldner is an independent writer and activist. He is author of numerous articles on political economy, including International Liquidity Crisis and Class Struggle, The Dollar Crisis and Us, 1973 Redux, Continuity and Discontinuity in the Decline of Dollar-Centered World Accumulation, two short texts on economic crisis and war, and Fictitious Capital and the Transition Out of Capitalism, among many other essays. He has lived abroad for extended periods in France, Germany, Spain, and Egypt. He has been active in social movements and important strikes in France in 2003. Currently, he lives in Korea and is writing a short book about the Korean working class. Lauren Goldner, welcome.
Well, I'm very glad to be on your show.
Lauren, you've written that U.S. foreign policy is in crisis. Certainly it has looked for a long time like the United States is conducting permanent war abroad. What, in your opinion, is the main driving force behind these wars?
Well, I think that the best way to think about it is in terms of a leap forward or kind of a running forward to avoid crisis in the rear. And this involves basically a huge crisis of the U.S. economy, of which we're starting to see very immediate consequences, such as in the subprime mortgage crisis. But this has been going on now for decades. And what it ultimately involves, what I'd like to talk about today, is this huge credit pyramid, which has kept the U.S. economy and the world economy going artificially now since really at least the 1970s.
Well, are you talking about an inflationary credit bubble?
Yes. Basically, the situation of the current world economy is one in which there is a tremendous amount of what I call fictitious capital. That's a term borrowed from Karl Marx, used by many other people, but not generally part of mainstream discussion of the economy. And by fictitious capital, I mean capital investments, demands for return in either the form of profit or interest or rent that really don't correspond to any kind of production in the what we could call the real economy. That's a somewhat loaded term we can unpack. And over time, since the late 1950s, really, but really accelerating since the early 1970s, the U.S. economy, through its financial system, has generated a historically unprecedented amount of this fictitious capital. It circulates just like normal capital circulates. And I want to quickly point out that there's no real boundary between this fictitious capital and real capital, but they coexist side by side. And to the typical mainstream point of view, economists, policymakers, they're indistinguishable, but they require profit. And if that profit doesn't come from normal capitalist production, it has to come from what I call loot. And loot being something that is essentially a free input to the system. Now, what is a free input to the system? One very common form is the importation of labor from other sectors of the world economy, and most notably in Europe and in North America, that's immigrant labor recruited from rural economies in Latin America, or in the case of Europe, the Middle East, or Africa. Another free input is the simple looting of nature, destruction of nature, say, for example, in the form of strip mining that produces a profit for a local capitalist, but at the same time produces huge social costs that are not paid for by that capitalist, but are paid for by society as a whole, or not paid for at all. So that is the fundamental process that I see going on today, that as this credit pyramid has become larger and larger, more and more of that looting has become necessary. I want to add that in addition to those free inputs, if you want to use a kind of technocratic term, there is also a form of looting internal to the system, and that is driving the wages of ordinary working people down below the level at which they can reproduce themselves, that is, have families, raise another generation of workers, or destroying existing plant and infrastructure, first of all by overuse, and then secondly by non-replacement. Again, the U.S. economy is an excellent example of that, where it's been a while since I've seen the exact figures, but it's estimated that something like $3 to $4 trillion of infrastructure replacement would be necessary, from, you know, the Chicago sewer system that burst several years ago and created huge amounts of damage, from an initial glitch that would have cost about $1,200 to repair. And anybody who's familiar with American cities can think of their own examples of that. So there's an external kind of pull into the system of labor and materials that aren't paid for, and at the same time, there's a grinding down in the system of what we would call normal reproduction. Of course, by normal, I merely mean normal in capitalist terms, not necessarily normal in human terms.
So would you say then that the system is cannibalizing itself, that it's not going to be able to infinitely reproduce itself?
That's exactly what I'm saying. I think if we look at the U.S. economy over the last 40 or 50 years, we can see this very clearly. Just to take one example, in the New York public school system, a city where I've lived for 5 or 10 years, there used to be an excellent system of elementary schools and high schools through which working class children would go to college and wind up in what Americans call the middle class. Now, again, I'm using these terms guardedly just to talk about a certain kind of social mobility. And over the last 30 or 40 years, that whole system has been interrupted and basically turned into one in which a huge number of kids are basically in dead-end situations and drop out of school, knowing full well that they have no future in the broader society. In France, where in 2005 there were riots in the suburbs of Paris of similar kids, in this case mainly immigrants, who were similarly cut off, they used the metaphor of the breaking of the social escalator. So there's simply one example of what I would call non-reproduction in society. That is, in a certain period of its history, myth of America, a working class child, had a certain opportunity to rise socially. And I would say that by and large, this has been turned into a very elite system.
Now, you've written that the worldwide boom is a result of a huge credit creation by the United States. How does the United States create credit?
Okay. Basically, following World War II, the United States replaced Great Britain as the world creditor. And that, in fact, had been going on since World War I, but just kind of episodically and sporadically. And the important result of World War II was to make the dollar into what's called an international reserve currency. And right at the end of World War II, the dollar had this reputation of being as good as gold. Now, what it meant in practice was that central banks around the world did not just accumulate gold out of international trade, they accumulated dollars and held them just in the same way they held gold. You can think of it as kind of a big poker game in which wins and losses are distributed around in the form of chits, and those chits today are literally dollars. And what was kind of novel about this system was that it gave the U.S. an ability to not only perform credit operations in its own domestic economy, but to essentially inflate or deflate the world economy. Now, starting in the late 1950s, this system became problematic for a simple reason, that the U.S. began to import more goods from abroad than it was exporting, and its competitive position, which after World War I was huge, that is hugely advantageous, began to deteriorate under competition from countries like Germany and a few years later from Japan, so that America's trade deficits began to produce dollars held in other central banks, and at the same time, inflation began to take off in the United States. So, for the first time, the world was experiencing in a small way what it is now experiencing in a gigantic way. Namely, they're holding these pieces of green paper, these chits of the system, at the same time that their value is eroding through domestic inflation in the United States. We can see this very clearly right now, where just a few days ago, the head of the Federal Reserve System, Benjamin Bernanke, testified before Congress that the Fed, as the Federal Reserve System is called, still is concerned about an inflationary bias in the U.S. economy and will not be reducing interest rates anytime soon. This is exactly what these international holders of dollars are concerned about, and above all, the Asian central banks, the big central banks of China, Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan, who hold altogether something on the order of $2 trillion, are saying to themselves, well, we have these dollars, we mainly invest them in U.S. assets, and above all, U.S. government assets like treasury bills. And at the same time, we see inflation in the U.S. Creeping up every quarter. How much longer are we going to hang on to these green pieces of paper as their value deteriorates? One can think of this international position of the dollar today something like a hot potato or a bag of hot air, something that nobody wants to really hold on to for too long. The dilemma in which foreign countries, foreign central banks, China first of all, are caught is, on one hand, because of their very positive trade balance with the U.S., which has been very seriously deindustrialized over decades, going back probably again to the late 1950s. They have deteriorating assets, and at the same time, because so much of their trade goes to the United States, fills up the shelves at Walmart, they have an interest in a certain stability of the dollar. So it's something like a kind of a mafia con game where if I owe you $1,000, I'm in trouble, but if I owe you $1,000,000, you're in trouble. You have an interest in my ongoing solvency. So the way in which this problem gets papered over is simply that these foreign creditors of the United States continue to recycle those dollars into American assets, American capital markets, and, as I said a moment ago, above all, into American government paper, which allows the whole game to continue. With that inflow of foreign funds, the U.S. is currently borrowing $2 to $3 billion a day to maintain its indebted situation in the world, to keep the whole credit system moving. And with this inflow of foreign funds, the Federal Reserve System and the U.S. Treasury just continue to reflate the economy, create new forms of credit in the U.S. Now, how does this connect up with the social deterioration that I was talking about? Because this money goes out into the economy and requires profit in different forms, that profit has to come from somewhere. And what it means essentially is that things that appear to capitalists, individual capitalists, but above all the capitalist class as a whole, that are considered superfluous, say, like education or social services, they have to be cut. And anybody who's been conscious for the last 3 or 4 decades knows that they've been cut very badly. So essentially, to support the growing credit pyramid, the system has to take real wealth from somewhere and basically shift it from things that benefit working people into things that can be profit for the capitalist class. As a result, as everyone knows, since the late 1960s, we've seen a huge reversal of income equality in the U.S. and everywhere else in the advanced capitalist world, not to mention many parts of the third world. I don't want to present a rose-tinted view of the pre-1970 U.S. economy. There was certainly serious income inequality at that time, but it's very interesting that figures show just about 1968, 1970, the wealthiest fifth of the population and the poorest fifth of the population started to move farther and farther apart, to the point that today they're farther apart than they were prior to the 1929 crash, which is the event that sort of ended the last period of crazed capitalist speculation. So there's a real interaction between the maintenance of this circulating fictitious capital and debt and the real material life of society.
I'm speaking with independent writer and activist Lauren Goldner. Today's show, Fictitious Capital, Real Retrogression. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. So is what you're describing, the deterioration of the economy, society for most of the people, is this a necessary and a direct result of the system of capitalism?
I would say absolutely. Now, to get into the reasons why that's the case, I have to go down, so to speak, another level, or up another level of abstraction. It's very easy, and there are many populist theories of the current situation in the U.S. that can focus on finance, debt pyramids. You just have to look on the internet, and you can find all kinds of people in places like Kansas and Idaho talking about bankers ruling the world and theories that have been around as long as capitalism has been around. But in reality, capitalism is a system in which the financial dimension is quite auxiliary to material production and reproduction. What is truly skewed and unreal about the contemporary world is that more and more it's the maintenance of this credit pyramid that begins to dominate material production and reproduction. So let me explain. At its real bottom level, capitalism is a system in which socially necessary labor time is the sort of fundamental common denominator for economic activity between the working class or individual groups of workers on one hand and capitalist investment on the other. That is, and this, of course, is the theory of Karl Marx, which was a certain important transformation of what is known as classical political economy, developed by figures like Adam Smith and Ricardo, that capitalism, through its activity and increasing of productivity, and even in the last three or four decades, there's been an important increase of productivity in some areas, tends to undermine the actual price paper values of different parts of the economy. Things in theory get cheaper and cheaper. Machines get cheaper. The cost of doing everything gets cheaper. We just have to think about the computer-connected revolution, so to speak, of the last two or three decades to see a case where the flow of information has expanded exponentially, and at the same time, you know, the cost of it has gone down radically, to see one example of capitalism cheapening commodities. The problem is that because the bedrock of the system is this relationship between the cost of the social time involved in reproducing labor power, that is, people capable of working, and the tools they work with, it tends to make things so cheap that the whole system is thrown into crisis. And what we have been seeing since the 1960s and 70s is a classic case of that. In the late 1960s, I would argue the system got to a point, which it had reached once or twice before, in which this general socially necessary labor time had been reduced by gains in productivity to a point that it could be superseded. In other words, that a new system that no longer depended on socially necessary labor time could replace it. And the most obvious expression of that at that time was a worldwide revolt of the working class against older forms of labor, and most memorably the assembly line. Some people refer to this as the Fordist phase of capitalism, the phase that came in the 1930s and 1940s with huge mass production factories, you know, symbolized above all by the auto industry. And throughout North America and Western Europe and in some countries of the underdeveloped world, third world, whatever you want to call it, there was from the mid-1960s to 1973, a huge working class revolt of wildcat strikes and organized strikes, and in a few cases, like Spain and Portugal, near revolutions, in which that form of labor was radically called into question. And I would say, and again we can unpack this further, almost everything that has happened in world capitalism since that time has been a reaction, a counter move. I'm not going to say counter-revolution because there was ultimately no revolution against the revolt of that period.
Exactly. Now, are you saying then that things get cheaper because of increased productivity, and this increased productivity is an integral part of a capitalist system, and so then the rate of profit falls? Is yes. That how it goes?
Yes. Capitalism is an anarchic system. Capitalism is a system in which hundreds, thousands of individual capitals pursue what they believe to be in their own immediate interest, so that an individual capitalist sees an opportunity to increase his or her profit level by introducing some new technology, and does so, and lo and behold, it works. The problem for the system is that, of course, that example is followed by other capitalists, and the gains in productivity tend to work their way through the whole system. We see, since the 1970s, a transport revolution, both in terms of air transport and shipping, as well as communications innovations that have made it possible to outsource and downsize older forms of production in a way that I think virtually nobody in the 1960s imagined possible. So that, for example, I just read a couple days ago that even distribution centers of goods in the U.S., which were previously thought of as fairly stable forms of employment, now that distribution work can essentially be done in countries like China and pinpointed in its delivery to the place where it's going to be sold. So something that would have been inconceivable prior to this kind of communications revolution and transport. So, and here I'm not even really talking about technology in production itself. I'm simply talking about auxiliary technology of transportation and communication. When we start to look at computer-controlled production and robotics in the production, say, of automobiles or steel, the ability of the system to cheapen goods becomes even greater.
I was going to ask you then, with this natural increase in productivity, which is a part of the system that then makes profits fall off, then are you saying that the problem here, or one of the problems inherent in the system, is that if there's not enough profit generated, then I guess that is why they're outsourcing to other countries? You mentioned the late 60s and early 70s, the wildcat strikes, the problems there, and then countermeasures taken by governments. When exactly was it that jobs started being sent overseas?
Okay, actually that does go back to the late 1950s. As the world recovered from World War II, there was a period of 10 or 15 years of quite stringent capital controls, meaning that national economies tended to be very much closed unto themselves, where the governments retained great power to regulate international trade and capital flows. Of course, the U.S. Was in a different situation. The U.S. was funding the recovery of Western Europe and Japan, and it was starting in the late 1950s that U.S. Production began to be outsourced to other countries, starting to Canada, where just over the border, but still with significantly lower wages, attracted U.S. industrial investment. And that process then continued in Western Europe in the early to mid-1960s. But let me get back to another aspect of your question. We have to realize that, you know, when we talk about capitalist development and we talk about things like investment, productivity, all the kinds of things that mainstream economics talk about, we're talking about people in and social relations in production and reproduction. And one of the most significant and understudied, underdiscussed aspects of the 1950s that was connected to a desire by U.S. capitalists to invest abroad was a growing shop floor working class rebellion, which above all expressed itself in the wildcat strikes in industries such as auto in the Midwest. In 1955, Walter Reuther, who was then the head of the United Auto Workers, came back from negotiations with the big three auto companies with a contract with unprecedented wage increases, benefits, et cetera, and so forth, thinking that this would be a great triumph. And the reaction of the auto workers themselves was a wildcat strike throughout the auto industry. And the message of the strike was basically, you can give us all the money you want, all the benefits you want, but what we do 8 hours a day or 10 hours a day is something totally out of our control. And we're going to die of boredom on the assembly line with these higher and higher benefits. And this, of course, somewhat astounded Ruther and the leadership of the UAW, but it showed that something fundamental in the production process was simply being neglected, because, as I said, it's not simply a question of these economic factors, but of the ability of working people to have real control over what they do every day. So this process, which began with investments in Canada in the late 50s, continued into Europe starting in the 60s, then went on to the countries in Asia, such as Taiwan and South Korea, which became known later as the Tigers, was part of this general process, a general, on one hand, search for higher profits, and on the other hand, a real concern by capitalists about the growing rebellion of labor in the capitalist heartland, in the U.S. initially, and then starting again in the mid-60s in Europe itself. The important thing to understand about this whole question of productivity, as I said, is the anarchic quality of the system. Individual capitalists do well for themselves by introducing, say, new technology, boosting productivity, and raising their profits. The problem is that because the system is coordinated ultimately by the market, a blind force, what is the advantage for an individual capitalist actually creates tremendous problems for the system as a whole. You can think of it as micro-rationality leading to macro-absurdity. And what that means is that as this productivity ripples through the whole system and cheapens the cost of all goods, it leaves the capitalists confronting two problems. One is that a machine, for example, that they paid for 3 years ago, say $1 million, expecting it to last for 10 years, by these productivity increases, has been depreciated far more rapidly, so that its book value, the value that they have to repay, usually to a bank, is already in excess of what it's actually worth today. And in some sense, we could describe that as a fundamental expression of the contradiction of the system, that the cost today of reproducing something because of these gains in productivity becomes far lower than what the capitalists individually and collectively are showing on their books. So that, and we want to get to the heart of this question of credit creation, the real role of the banking system and the Federal Reserve is to stave off, you know, this fire sale, bargain basement auction of greatly cheapened commodities that we call a depression, the last big one happening in 1929, and a more slow-motion version of it happening since the late 60s, early 1970s. In other words, credit creation up to a point when it's supplemented by all these free inputs that I mentioned, both from outside of the system and also in terms of grinding down living standards of working people inside the system, can put off for some time the day of reckoning. But as anyone can see reading the papers today, I think we're getting pretty close to that day of reckoning.
I'm speaking with independent writer and activist Lauren Goldner. Today's show, Fictitious Capital, Real Retrogression. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
The system may work for an individual capitalist, but as a whole, it's completely irrational.
Right. Now, from the vantage point of the theory of Karl Marx, which anyone listening to this show can see I'm very strongly influenced by, there's an additional problem, which is what Marxists tend to call the falling rate of profit. And that is very closely related to the phenomenon I was just talking about. That is, on one level, we see this clash between the historical cost of say a machine versus its current cost of reproduction. That's one problem, and that problem blurs over into this more fundamental problem, which is that over time, the total amount of labor time required to materially reproduce the whole system gets lower and lower, so that at a certain point, and I think, again, we got there in the 1960s, and I think it could be argued that the system even got there sometime around World War I, that in terms of the actual capitalist system as a whole, the ability of the system to regenerate and to have a new period of expansion based on socially necessary labor time fritters away. Marx talked about this both in Capital and in his other book, The Grundrisse, as capital becoming an obstacle to itself, that socially necessary labor time, the time society really requires to provide the basis of material reproduction, people and the tools they work with and the cities they live in or wherever they live, it becomes such a small part of the totally available labor time that that kind of standard, the operation of the market, the operation of what Marx has called the law of value, becomes obsolete. And what we see when the system doesn't transcend itself, isn't transcended in a positive way into another kind of society that would be beyond these kinds of considerations, there's huge retrogression. That is, the system basically, and this is again what we're seeing now and what we've seen for decades, the system has to basically turn back on itself and force things back to a situation in which, from a capitalist point of view, a rate of profit becomes possible. And this is, I think, if what I'm saying is true, I think it's the key to many, if not all, of the important social phenomena that we've seen over the last 30 or 40 years.
Yes, I see what you mean. The increased productivity should be able to free people. But in order to keep within this system, the economy has to be broken down and destroyed and rebuilt in order to keep the same, in order to not transcend this system.
Exactly. And for those listeners who remember the late 1960s and early 1970s, you may recall a spate of books and articles in the media. I remember a cover of Newsweek or Time or whichever magazine of that kind it was, saying with a cover story, "Can America survive the four-day week?" It was very common, including in New Left circles at that time, to talk about the leisure society and the problems of the leisure society. And at a certain point, at its lowest, the average work week in the U.S. dropped to about 39 hours per week. Now, all of this sounds almost like fantasy land today, where the average work week has increased at least, you know, by official statistics, of which I'm highly dubious, to, you know, 46, 47 hours a week. In other words, about a 20% increase. And much more important, and this probably is the most important single fact, so to speak, of social reproduction I can point to in the U.S., is the way in which a working class family, circa 1960, could survive and reproduce itself, so to speak, that is, educate the new generation and engage in the kinds of leisure that were possible at that time, on one paycheck. And as we know, the one paycheck family has more or less gone the way of the dinosaur. Now, let me quickly say that I'm quite aware that the overwhelming majority of those single paychecks were earned by men and mainly by white men. So there was a whole other element of distortion in there. But the fact remains that today, when two and sometimes three paychecks not to mention working poor people working two and three jobs, barely hanging on. I mean, there's the famous case, the well-known case of working poor who are homeless and holding down one or two jobs at minimum wage. This is another indicator of exactly this kind of retrogression I was talking about, where the system seemed to be on the threshold of simply going beyond socially necessary labor time in order to create a humane society with goals totally different from capital accumulation. Instead, you get a tremendous retrogression of social conditions, of which we can talk about symptoms till the end of this show, if you want.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about how the system is being kept afloat presently. And people, of course, have been expecting for decades for the system to go under, but it keeps going. Now, yes, we've got this big credit bubble. We've got this U.S. consumer of last resort. We have these subprime mortgages. Now that is unfolding. How do you see things right now and in the near future?
Okay, well, I'm one of those people who's been expecting the whole thing to tank since probably the early 1970s. And basically, you'll often see mainstream coverage of economic matters in the newspapers and other media a reference to the U.S. consumer-driven world economy. And there is a lot of truth to that, that what has been going on periodically and certainly since the 1970s and the Ronald Reagan era, the 1980s, has been credit creation in the U.S., which has been subsidized by the system I mentioned earlier of foreign countries lending money to the U.S. government to expand credit, give consumer credit to large parts of the U.S. population. Over decades, there's just been a almost constant year-in, year-out increase in the indebtedness of individuals and families. Now, this is subsidized ultimately by these foreign creditors and by the increase of American government debt. It's important to recall that at the time Ronald Reagan came to power in 1980, the total debt accumulated by the U.S. state going back to its origins was $1 trillion. And 20 years later, in 2000, it was $4 trillion. So just right there, we can see an enormous increase in federal indebtedness. And that increase from $1 to $4 trillion was made possible by Asian banks, European banks, Middle Eastern oil producers, funneling the dollars they receive for selling goods to the United States back into American capital markets and to the U.S. government debt. That's just another aspect of what we could call the financialization of the system. This is something, again, that I think is probably widely understood by the listeners, that the role of the financial system, this has been part of what has been touted since the 1960s as the shift to a service economy. In the next few years, as people who work in the subprime mortgage field are going to learn, this service economy has mainly been a term to refer to people who are employed in the circulation of this fictitious capital, all kinds of financial advisors and other creators of what are called new financial products, which become more and more complex to the point that today on Wall Street, the typical economic analyst working for Goldman Sachs has a PhD not in economics or econometrics, but in astrophysics or mathematics, because the ultimate architecture, as they call it, of the system has become so complicated that even the CEOs don't understand it. But what it does come down to, when you step back and look at it, is a huge increase of financial assets relative to what we can guardedly call real assets. That is, the things that people actually consume and the things that are needed, you know, to produce those things. So I would say that process is the main thing that it has kept the system going all this time. That, again, and it's important always to keep this in mind, combined with what I call the free inputs into the system. That is, if the U.S. did not have the ability to tap huge amounts of wealth from abroad, both in the form of immigrant labor, let me just dwell on that for a moment. Immigrant labor has two advantages for American capitalists. One is, of course, it tends to push down general wage levels for all workers in the economy. The second one, and probably more important, is that from the point of view of American capitalists, it comes free to the system. They do not have to pay for the child care and education of such labor power. Those are paid for by the rural societies from which immigrant workers are recruited. And so across the board, in terms of the total wage expenses that the capitalists have to lay out, it's a huge savings. And then, again, as I said, the simple looting of natural resources, non-replacement of resources, non-innovation of technologies that can overcome the depletion of resources such as petroleum, all of these are ways in which the system, in addition to this credit run-up, gets further steam to stagger on a few more years.
I'm speaking with independent writer and activist Lauren Goldner. Today's show, Fictitious Capital, Real Retrogression. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Well, now, Lauren, we could talk about a foreign war and how that and why that's an integral part of keeping this system going.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point, and anyone listening to most of what I've said up to now might get the impression that I had a purely economic or economist view of reality. My actual view is that this is all very tied up with politics and with foreign policy and war. The subtitle of Marx's book, Capital, is The Critique of Political Economy, and I insist on that as opposed to any kind of economics as the kinds of realities that I'm discussing. I do not believe, and the history of the 20th century, I think, bears me out in this, that we will see a purely economic crisis. What we're seeing, as I started to say at the beginning of the show, was that there's an element of flight forward by U.S. foreign policy that I see as very integrally tied to these economic problems we've been discussing. And let me just elaborate on that. Even influential, well-known figures like Henry Kissinger and Brzezinski for 20 or 30 years have been talking in their books pretty openly about America as a declining imperial power. The essence of U.S. foreign policy, and let me just at this point plug one very interesting book written by a Frenchman named Emmanuel Todd, came out circa 2000 in France, and then was translated into English in 2003 under the title After Empire, which he lays out, you know, something quite similar to what I'm saying, namely that the true aim of U.S. foreign policy in many parts of the world, which in some ways might seem inexplicable, actually is the creation of chaos. That is, when a hegemon, you know, the lone superpower, as the U.S. has been called since 1991, emerges, there tends to be a world realignment of other countries into one coalition against it. This happened famously in the 17th century during the period of Louis XIV in France, where France was such a dominant military power on the European continent that it wound up creating a huge anti-French alliance of virtually every other country. And U.S. foreign policy today I see as aimed at preventing exactly the same thing. We see Brzezinski, for example, wrote a, in my opinion, very enlightening book in the late 90s. The title was either The Great Chess Game or The Great Chessboard, something like that, in which he outlined five potential rival centers to to the U.S. And saying very openly that we've got to recognize that the U.S. is a declining power. And what should we do about this? Well, the best thing we can do is divide our potential enemies and try to negotiate the best possible terms of decline. Well, this is a pretty remarkable statement from somebody who was Jimmy Carter's national security advisor in the late 70s. And he said, okay, let's look at the map out there. We've got Europe, we've got Russia, we have China, or East Asia as a whole, China, Korea, Japan, India, and Indonesia, all of them major or rising economic players in the world economy. And Brzezinski specifically points in his book at East Asia as the true main potential rival of the U.S. And what we have to do is find ways to keep them off balance relative to each other. And at the time, it's kind of ironic, he all but said a useful tool in this is Islamic fundamentalism. So maybe we should support the Chechens a little bit in Russia, as we supported the Afghans against the Soviet invasion in the 1980s. Maybe we should stir things up in Kashmir to keep India and Pakistan off balance. And let's maybe support the Aceh Liberation Forces in Indonesia and the Uyghurs in Western China. Now, let me quickly point out that Brzezinski was not advocating Islamic revolutions for these parts of the world. He was simply saying that these could be useful tools for tweaking these potential rivals and keeping them busy with other things besides creating a U.S., anti-U.S. world coalition. We can look at U.S. foreign policy very much as an attempt to keep the world from bolting from this dollar-denominated financial system, from creating an independent pole that could rival the United States, and that U.S. foreign policy for the foreseeable future can be read in those terms. And I think whether the Democrats or the Republicans win the 2008 elections, it will change mainly the rhetoric with which those goals are pursued. So I think, you know, what I would like people to come away with above all in this talk is a recognition that what looks like relatively normal business as usual capitalism today is such a distortion of the human potential of the society as a whole, and not just America, but on a world scale, that what is really required is a sort of programmatic imagination that could foresee the end of huge parts of what is currently called work and the transformation of what is left, socially, truly socially necessary work, into something else that would just create a kind of society based on human needs that would be just almost unrecognizable compared to contemporary reality.
You have mentioned the need for a social slash economic revolution that would benefit most people in this country, perhaps in the world, of course. The government or the owners must realize this as well. Do you see the domestic situation here in the United States as dangerous for political dissidents, for instance?
Well, I think there's no question about that. I mean, what we've seen since 9/11 is just an appetizer, a dress rehearsal for the kind of repression that could be brought to bear on any broader movement that the capitalists would sense as threatening their power. I think if we think back to the late 60s and early 70s, we can see a much wider kind of repression. The apparatus of police red squads and national intelligence agencies involving themselves, infiltrating and trying to influence oppositional politics, the unbelievable, or actually quite believable, changes in the concept of constitutionality that have happened, particularly under the Bush administration. All of this sets the stage for effectively a kind of electronically monitored police state that would make Nazi Germany or Stalinist Russia look like a libertarian society. I think the apparatus that's already in place could be tweaked very quickly into something that would be much more intrusive into the lives not just of marginal people or people who are selected out as victims to sort of reinforce social solidarity, but something much more on the scale of the 1919-1920 Palmer Raids, Red Scare, or the post-World War II McCarthyite period. So there's no question that as a movement of ordinary working people that would begin to threaten the power of the capitalist class came into existence, that we would see a huge expansion of this kind of repression. But I think compared to what we've seen so far, what we would see in the event of the emergence of a real movement challenging the system at its foundations is, you know, or just, it would be in another dimension.
Lauren Goldner, thank you very much.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
There's something happening here. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I've been speaking with independent writer and activist Lauren Goldner. Today's show has been Fictitious Capital, Real Retrogression. Lauren Goldner is author of numerous articles on political economy, including International Liquidity Crisis and Class Struggle, The Dollar Crisis and Us, 1973 Redux, Continuity and Discontinuity in the Decline of Dollar-Centered World Accumulation, two short texts on economic crisis and war, and Fictitious Capital and the Transition Out of Capitalism, among many other essays. His articles have appeared in Against the Current, New Politics, Critique, and Collective Action Notes. He has lived abroad for extended periods in France, Germany, Spain, and Egypt. He has been active in social movements and in important strikes in France in 2003. Currently, he lives in Korea and is writing a short book about the Korean working class. Lauren Goldner's articles are posted at his website, Break Their Haughty Power. For a link to his website, go to gunsandbutter.net. Today's show was co-produced by Todd Fletcher. Guns and Butter is edited and produced by Bonnie Faulkner and Yara Mako. Our engineer is Bonnie Bone. To leave comments or order copies of the show, email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.net. That's faulkner@gunsandbutter.net. Or visit our website at www.gunsandbutter.net.
Hey, yo, these are some serious times that we're living in, G. And our new world order is about to begin. You know what I'm saying? Now, the question is, are you ready for the real revolution, which is the evolution of the mind? If you seek, then you shall find that we all come from the divine. You dig what I'm saying?
On April 15, 1949, Pacifica Radio went on the air for the first time, introducing listener-sponsored community radio to America. The year was 1964. Buddhist monks in South Vietnam were setting themselves on fire. Lyndon Johnson was preparing to bomb the North. Three civil rights workers, Cheney, Schwerner, and Goodman, had been murdered in Mississippi, and demonstrations erupt throughout the South. College students return to their campuses in the fall. Thousands of them have spent the summer in the South working on voter registration drives, witnessing and experiencing extraordinarily violent and blatant racism. Inspired by the civil rights movement and leery of the growing war in Asia, students began speaking out, fundraising, and organizing other students for political action and support. At the University of California at Berkeley, President Clark Kerr tried to stifle all political expression on campus. His ban was met with a new kind of student activism against the university itself. The free speech movement at Berkeley was born out of this conflict, and its most visible leader was Mario Savio. Pacifica Station KPFA recorded Savio at one of the early FSN rallies.
By the time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part, you can't even passively take part, and you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop, and you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Mario Savio, from the Pacifica Radio Archives.
Welcome to the Million Color Revolution.